Last Wanpra, we played a recording of Ajahn Suchito giving a talk, which seemed to be greatly appreciated by everybody that I talked to anyway about it. It's one that I had listened to a couple of times. And also had been following a theme. He had been bringing up that theme of upadana, clinging, attachment, in several recorded talks that I had been listening to, and have been finding that a subject of contemplation in my own practice for the past bit of time, really, maybe even the past 6 months, a year. Just find myself frequently turning to that as a theme for internal reflection. And so I thought I'd grind it into the ground a little more tonight. You've probably heard of various bits and pieces of this in some of the sharings that I've done over the past bit of time, so sorry if it's repetitive or certainly not as eloquent and succinct as Ajahn Suchito, but stuff that keeps revolving around in my consciousness. One of the benefits of getting a little bit older, and now that I'm 63, I have the right to repeat myself a lot. So, here you go. I think about upadana and what's the kind of underlying basis or urge that's propelling us to this holding, clinging experience that we keep on putting ourselves through. And this, in my mind, I mean, there's various ways you can look at it, but one of the ways is this drive for security, drive for safety. looking for a refuge, in a way. This basic sense of wanting to be grounded in what sometimes feels like a very ungrounded experience. Living, just living, can be very ungrounding, and most of our activity, most of our waking activity is involved in some way with trying to find this stability, security. So this is a reflex almost, this whole process. The Buddha describes it and focuses around, of course, the stages of becoming, the stages of how we suffer. And in a way, three major driving forces that are part of this process. Seems like this whole idea of clinging focuses around this, the nexus of tanha, upadana, bhava. Those three factors in the progression towards becoming birth, dukkha, tanha, craving, upadana, clinging, bhava, becoming. So craving, clinging, becoming. And how the underlying tendencies, the habits, latch on to old familiar patterns to try and find that sense of groundedness, that sense of stability. in any way possible. We develop all sorts of refuges to help ground us, to define us, to give us a place in the world. And because we don't know any better, we just keep on seeking and grabbing ways that we have gotten a little bit of security in the past in hopes for getting just a little bit more. Grab onto anything that we can when we're struggling, especially. Kind of reminds me of a time early in the monastery when we were exploring the outer reaches. There weren't any loop trails or really any kind of paths. It was pretty rough land with a rudimentary trail where this our road now is, which had been an old logging road before, as a way of starting to get into the forest, and then you were on your own after that, just bushwhacking. And there was a time when myself and Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Vasuti, who were the first three residents here, me as an Anagarika, we were doing some exploring deep in the woods. And of course, as everybody knows, the hillside is incredibly steep. And it can be kind of treacherous if you know if you kind of get into some of those rugged, steep areas. And there was one time when we were on a steep slope, kind of traversing around a gully or a creek bed, trying to skirt around the inside edge of it. And it got to one point where the ground was very crumbly and very rocky, and a very steep descent down into the creek bed below it. And Ajahn Amaro was leading the way, and he was scampering his way across, of course. And Ajahn Vasuti was in front of me, and he was having a little bit more of a hard time, and I was not too far behind him, kind of just trying to keep a foothold here and there. And Ajahn Vasuti started to slip, and and it was really kind of a little bit scary, a little bit treacherous, because you know, if he slipped and fell, slid all the way down, it would have been quite a tumble. He might have really hurt himself. And he looked around for something to grab onto, and the only thing that was available was this poison oak bush. And I was watching, okay, what's he going to do here? And he looked down below him, and then he looked up above him at the poison oak bush, and he looked back down below him, looked back up at the poison oak, and grabbed the poison oak. So it's, to me, it's sort of like, you know, and he had to do that, because there wasn't anything else to grab onto. And so that's kind of like, in my mind, a good metaphor for what we do. Because we're about to fall, or we're about to collapse, or you know, have a collision, or whatever it is, we grab onto whatever we can, even if it's poison oak. So we grab onto our old poisonous habits, our habitual ways of responding, reacting, just because there's nothing else that we know of to hold on to. So all the old, you know, standbys that everybody knows, has heard about, you know, looking for security and the usual worldly ways of establishing, you know, wealth, financial security, our investment portfolio, our, you know, savings, our jobs, our livelihoods, you know, working towards a secure retirement. I just became eligible for Social Security myself. So, you know, there's a lot of stock put in financial stability, particularly in our country, where if you don't do it yourself, you're not going to have all that much to hang on to. I've read that Social Security income is what keeps about 40% of the elderly from living at the poverty level. But financial security, security, and just the pleasure of the five senses. It's what we know. We go out to sights and sounds and tastes and tactile sensations, ideas, the body, the mind, and we look for familiar pleasures, and we move into them with craving, clinging, and becoming. They become who we are. We possess them in some way, or we identify with them in some way, because they, as fleeting as they are, as meager as they may be, they give us a sense of familiarity, a sense of security. This is the American dream, you know, in a way, the American dream. We grow up a bit, we go to school, we mature, we try and establish a livelihood of some sort. If we follow the rules, we do it the way that we're supposed to, then we have our investments, our savings, our homes, our partners, our 2.1 children, and three cats in the yard. Yeah, and then we kind of move on, and according to the American dream, and you know, we make our contributions, we keep the economy moving, we pay our taxes, we pay into Social Security, and then the reward is a comfortable retirement, you know, somewhere between the ages of 60 and 70, and this is what we call a successful life, successful aging, modern maturity, the magazine of the AARP, you know. And if the most successful of us are, you know, we get our picture on the front of Modern Maturity, I think Paul McCartney, you know, that was the last one I saw, it was Paul McCartney, somewhat aged Paul McCartney, looking a little bit gray around the edges, a little bit jowly around the cheeks, but this epitome of successful aging, you know, kind of still, of course, quite healthy and vigorous, looking a little bit wise, a few little crinkles around the eyes, but sometimes nice and tanned, and you know, still vigorous and exercising, and maybe a few little facelifts here and there, eye tucks, whatever they are, you know. But this kind of ideal aging. This is what the American dream is all about. And funny how it kind of stops there, isn't it? It just that's the pinnacle, and we don't really get lots of pictures on the front page of Modern Maturity of Karuna Damo in a wheelchair, you know, crouched over, saying to Janaka, "Where's my oatmeal? You forgot to put the flaxseed on top of it." We don't see that so much being put out there as the American dream. But it's it's a secure image. It gives us a little bit of, you know, something to go on, something to get through the day. by holding on to that. Or if we kind of, you know, have seen through some of that and kind of, you know, we're all, well, not all of us, actually, just a few of us are, you know, children of the 60s, so we had all the rebellious, you know, not going to buy into that attitude. And then the subsequent generations, you know, have their own ways of not buying into the mainstream in various ways. But how many of us over the years kind of start to see the idealism, you know, of the ultimate society, the age of Aquarius start to fade a little bit, and maybe start to feel a little bit like on shaky ground, and that all of those lofty ideals kind of maybe are not quite so solid as they seem to be when we were very youthful and idealistic, and you know, the buying into the system that can happen, and the movement from that kind of rebellious against the stream kind of thing, turning into looking for a little bit more security and stability in the ways that we used to kind of deride our elders for. It's so easy to fall back into that. But nevertheless, still a few people kind of squeak through with thinking, this is not exactly where I want to place all of the eggs in my basket. I don't want to place all of my eggs in these baskets. And we look for other more meaningful ways of relating to the world, sometimes in the realm of relationships. We can all benefit from being in skillful relationships. We turn to the presence of other people to help provide mirrors for us, to help us grow and reflect. But we can see how clinging upadana can come into those as well. If we start to take them for granted, or even develop, even, you know, in skillful relationships, much less the unskillful ones, but the skillful relationships, how if we're not careful, we become dependent on the presence of, say, one other person, or maybe your family, spouse, children, whatever, to give you that sense of stability, that sense of security, because you know, we're very clever at finding ways to garner support and praise and appreciation from others. And we can become dependent on that, almost that you know, way of being codependent. We know how to make each other feel good enough so that we don't have to feel that sense of instability, insecurity, of aloneness. So there's a sense of at least, you know, some ease of mind in what we perceive as stability in a relationship, and when we become dependent on that, it's pretty sneaky sometimes. So reflecting on that and seeing that, well, that's maybe more skillful, but still another subtle form of tanha upadana bhava. I'm a good spouse, I'm a good father, I'm a good mother, I'm a good son, good daughter. Do what we can to keep the unit functioning and operating. We don't want it to fall apart. And then things happen, you know. People move on. Drift apart, separation, divorce sometimes, or illness, death. And we realize that it's shaky ground if we've put our eggs in that basket completely. So, you know, people, many of us here, most of us here probably reflect on that and realize that it's not actually the best place to hold to cling to upadan, as Ajahn Sucitto says. And I start to look more inwards, maybe pick up a meditation practice, a bit more self-reflection, go on some retreats, spend time at the monastery, and start to move inwards, and start to see the internal workings of the mind, all the different mental habits and personalities and in different experiences in the mental world that are so habituated, and those can become, you know, blatantly and painfully clear as we develop a contemplative practice. And we see those personalities and those characteristics, those traits, as they rise up in response to external circumstances, rise up and take hold. And we move into them in the same way with that kind of tanha, upadana, bhava. And find ourselves just reacting in the habitual ways, because at least it's familiar. If painful, it's still painful, but better something familiar, even if it's not skillful, or it just leads to more suffering. So, you know, we have the habits of perhaps, you know, negativity, all the feelings that can come up living in or being in community or being on retreat, and all the some memories might come up, or unfinished business with people, or ongoing business with people that keeps churning when the mind starts to go quiet, and, you know, or the sense of feeling burdened in our community, or feeling afflicted, or somehow trapped, or you know, the same stimulation comes up from the same person. You know, we can externally blame somebody who's being unskillful, and find ourselves kind of lying in wait, just watching, waiting for an unskillful action, just to prove prove the truth of our projection onto others. And sometimes feeling like the victim, you know, it's everybody else's fault. I've got it right. And then just as those kinds of old habits start to flare up, those ways of perceiving the world and our relationships around it and our responses to it, and then, you know, those are painful and those are difficult, and then we start to add even another layer of blaming ourselves, of, oh, this is hopeless, this is, you know, I'll never get over this, I can't stand this anymore. If it's, you know, if we've seen through the blaming others, then we move into the blaming ourselves, and the cycles continue. Or we develop our escape fantasies, you know. Whether it's, if we're on a retreat or something like that, well, it's like, oh, okay, well, it's only 2 more months until the end of retreat. I'll be able to make it if I can just get through the next 2 months. Or you know, with longer term, just like, okay, well, I'm out of here, you know, I don't have to stay here, you know, I can make my plans, it'll be better somewhere else, I won't have to deal with so-and-so in this other monastery or in this other situation, or I'll be able to do something different, we won't have so much work to do, I'll have more open space, and I can really jump in and you know, live the ideal of the forest monastic or the wilderness dweller, and you know, move into the peacefulness of tranquility of a simple life, just me and nature. You know, walking for alms daily and having my days abiding out in that peaceful nature, and you know, slowly chip away and work my way towards realization and truth and nibbana. We have those escape fantasies. And so we work on those, try and fulfill them. Or, you know, we have our ideals of practice and how to go about it, and until things start to get a little bit lonely. Maybe there's something to do over there. Maybe I'll go somewhere else and be with a few more people and have a little more company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we keep on bringing our habits with us wherever we go, wherever our escape fantasies take us. We don't leave those behind. So these are all different kinds of ways that, you know, we kind of follow into that, or fall into that loop, craving, clinging, becoming, trying to establish security, point of reference. And I really enjoyed the way that Ajahn Suchito pointed out that there is an alternative, and that there's another form of holding, another form of, it's not really grasping, but a form of holding experience that can provide a bit more skillful way of being in the world. It can be described by the Buddha in one of the suttas as knowing the proper range. I think Ajahn Titapanya referred to that in some recent discussion we were having or reading, or I can't remember exactly where it came up, but the proper range, so that the improper range of a practitioner is when we get pulled and lost in the sense faculties, the sensory world around us, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, tactile sensations, and also, I would add, the realm of ideas, the mental realm. We get trapped in those and get involved with craving and clinging and becoming in those. But and that's the improper range of a practitioner, but that the proper range of where we can rightfully do some holding would be in the four satipatthana, the four foundations or the four establishings of mindfulness. And that this itself is a form of holding too, the whole notion, the whole aspect of sati is a way of recollecting and attending appropriate attention to that which is going to be skillful. it is still a form of holding, but whereas upadana is holding or clinging based on defilement or kilesa controlling the show, kilesa is controlling where it is that we're holding on to, what we're holding on to, but that we can employ discernment and wisdom to take over and use sati, mindfulness, sammasati, right mindfulness, as a tool for holding, at least for a period of time that's useful and skillful, so that we can substitute one form of holding for another one, we substitute one that's more skillful for one that's less skillful. So that's the instruction, is to develop these four places of skillful holding, maybe would be a way to phrase it. And starting with holding on to, reflecting on, immersing ourselves in the body. This can be a place of security, a place of holding our attention, of a place to turn to, that provides a ground of stability that's rooted in discernment and wisdom. Because, as the teachings tell us, as we learn more about the teachings and reflect on them, then we see that they will holding in these areas will lead to peace, calm, and clarity enough so that we can see where we're unskillfully holding and how to release, how to let go. So this could be maybe the holding that leads to the end of holding. So grounding in the body, really developing that as a refuge. This could be the primary point of refuge for us, the most efficacious place of security, putting our attention in this fathom-long body, seeing where it is that we are holding, where we're upadaning, going through, scanning, feeling the tension, the obstructions, because every mental state of holding can be felt within the body. Any place where there's clinging, mental clinging, has a corresponding spot. I should be so bold as to say that. Every place where there's mental clinging, we can feel that reflected in the body. So just really the bulk of our practice, the bulk of our experience, mindfulness immersed in the body, feeling the clinging, the holding in the face, the muscles of the face, around the eyes, just relaxing the tension, relaxing the obstruction, the cheeks or around the mouth, the jaw, where it is that holding, clinging will find a grip. The neck and the shoulders, it seems like this upper part of the body, particularly the head and the neck and the face and the shoulders and the upper chest and back, those are really prime spots of clinging, where clinging manifests, holding manifests. And we can hold so much there, hold so much mental energy in this upper part of the body. So just seeing it and consciously just breathing through it, relaxing it, letting it drop. Over and over again. And then going down through the whole body, feeling the whole body very lightly, just experiencing the whole body in a very whole way, wholesome way of lightness, noticing the holding, the clinging, and just going there and saying, okay, let go. And then noticing where it grabs on again somewhere back in the face and going back up there. Okay, let go. Breathe, relax, let go. And how it may not get rid of the underlying tendencies or the underlying defilements altogether, but how it allows us to see very clearly where we're gripping, what we're gripping. And oftentimes in that experience of attention to and release of the holding in the body gives us a real clear picture of the mental holding, the mental clinging, the tension that we create through trying to hold on to old secure ways, old ways of giving security, stability to ourselves, those old habits, those old tendencies, those old grievances, those old self-recriminations, how that holding can be attended to first through the body and released. And then the other satipatthanas, the other places where we can focus our light holding around feelings, pleasant and unpleasant, and staying grounded in the body, watching how the mind is constantly lurching, moving towards getting the pleasant, towards resisting the unpleasant. We're clinging to both the pleasant and the unpleasant, because in our resistance, our wish to avoid the aversion that we experience towards unpleasant, we're establishing a relationship with it that actually holds us to it, keeps us in association with it through our own irritation or aversion or wish that it would go away, wish the circumstances would change, wish the internal reactions would change, all of those ways we can experience not wanting establishes us in association with that state of mind. That, and we cling to it, we grab onto it in some perverse way that we think that we'll somehow get rid of it. So we mindfully attend to that and watch that. And if we're grounded in the body, we're breathing, we feel it, we release it in the body, then that gives us a bit more space to see the clinging towards feelings clearly. And when we see it more clearly, a natural relaxing and opening and release will start to manifest in little ways and then in larger ways over time. Or the mind itself, the various states of mind that we can experience, the ways that various kilesa can program, or not program so much, but condition the mind so that we can experience contracted states of mind or aversive states, of course, the ways that desires and aversions feel in the heart, the contractedness or the distractedness of the negative ones, or the positive, beautiful, expansive states of mind that we can experience through proper reflection, proper attending to qualities that lead to peacefulness or to kindness, to discernment, and to see the change of heart that happens with that, mindfully attending to the state of the mind without any judgment in terms of rightness or wrongness, but at least in the initial stages, just noticing and being open to accepting with clarity, mindful attention to the quality of mind. What is it actually like? So holding on to that kind of reflective state as a way of seeing clearly. And the dhammas, the fourth grouping of places where we can put skillful holding, all the investigation of the hindrances, getting to know them, knowing how they're nourished, how we make them come into being more strongly, and how we can de-nourish them, how we can let them go skillfully. So knowing their presence, knowing what causes them to arise, what causes them to relax, pass away, and cease, and move into the development of the skillful qualities of the seven factors of awakening, all those wonderful, skillful qualities leading up to collectedness and equanimity, and getting to know those bit by bit. Holding on to investigations around the aggregates, seeing how clinging and craving associated with our forms and feelings and perceptions, all the mental states, the programs, the experiences, the ways we weave consciousness into reality. Looking at how those five khandhas, when they're affected by clinging and craving, lead to suffering, the root cause of suffering, the root cause of identity, the establishment of I am, or this is mine, around the five aggregates, or the six sense bases, how the mind lurches from one sense base to another and into the realm of ideas, being yanked around and controlled by the unskillful qualities of mind, the kilesa, drawing us out over and over again into that unskillful upadana. So we use this proper range, holding on to mindfulness of these four satipatthana. This is our point of reference. This is how we skillfully can attach to something, at least for a period of time. And in that holding, in that reflection, always going back to the body, holding attention very gently and very thoroughly, moving always back to the breathing, back to the bodily experience, in a skillful way, to know where it is that we're holding, where we're upadaning in an unskillful way, where we're creating our world of experience over and over again, how the kilesas grab hold, manifest, and how our mindfulness can see clearly so that we can release, relax, and gradually replace upadana with sati. So this is where taking the teachings, you know, these are very practical teachings. These are not just teachings that we read about and learn about and memorize and can recite or expound. These are things to really take in, open aiko, really take in for really embodying them, knowing them, and using them. And that way we're actually starting to get on the freeway and take the trip rather than just mapping it out. We have to know enough of the map, we have to experience enough of it, and learn enough of it to be able to get on the freeway and getting us towards our destination. But we don't have to know all the side trips, we don't have to know all the places and the details that are off of the exit ramp in different places, and how to get back on. We just have to know that the map is there and follow the course that we've chosen, and then if we get waylaid, if we get lost, then we have a map that we can refer to. But at some point we have to just start walking the path. So really bringing it in, and using it. And that's what retreat time is so useful for. We've got this extended period where we can just keep on keep on coming back to putting it into motion and putting it into reality. And we bring in other kinds of things to help soften it too. You know, sometimes it can become a lot of work. We can become kind of heavily burdened with the work that needs to be done and the hours on the cushion or the hours on the walking path and to really just bring in reflections that help soften and bring some ease and relaxation and delight, just to recollecting, going back to those recollections of kindness. That's the best one, kindness and compassion, you know, bringing up thoughts of softness and gentleness for ourselves, for our fellow treaders on the path, because we can start to think that we're kind of the center of this this struggle, this path, and forget to look around us and glean the support from just the people who are here with us, doing it alongside of us, and to really enjoy that sense of community, that sense of, hey, well, there's a few people who are interested in doing this other than me, and just being here with them is a great gift, and to be able to gently smile inside of ourselves and offer ourselves that that appreciation for who we're with, where we are at, and the good fortune of being with like-minded people. We can always bring to mind Mr. Rogers too. He's always good for a sense of okay, well, you know, I accept myself the way I am, because Mr. Rogers would. I like you. I love you just the way you are. So, you know, channel Mr. Rogers for ourselves, for everybody else, and see if we can keep on developing skillful holding patterns as our place of security, to start to let go of the unskillful ways we've tried to establish our security in the world. So I'll leave that for tonight's reflection.